Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the CMS school board rejects Superintendent Crystal Hill's proposed budget and sends her back to the drawing board. She feels she needs more direction and is told,
"You will get direction."
The Medicaid funding stalemate ends as Governor Stein signs a $319 million deal. School systems cancel classes as teachers flock to Raleigh today to march for better teacher pay. Charlotte City Council wrangles over public hearings on data centers and seeks a pause on what some describe as irreversible actions involving the I-77 toll lane project. And get ready to adjust your AC thermostat. Duke Energy wants a rate hike in June. We hear about those stories and more from Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News. David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So let me begin with something we just found out about seconds ago, and that is they have now enacted mandatory water restrictions in the Catawba Watery Lake system, which means Mecklenburg County and Charlotte residents. Talk about that, Eli. What do we know?
Yeah, so this is the first time since 2009 that we've been in this drought stage. It's not a big surprise. We knew that restrictions were likely sometime in May because we are really far, more than about 17 inches where we should be. And this is a deficit that's built up over a long time since last fall. So the goal is to really start significantly reducing restrictions now, or water usage through mandatory restrictions, and that can include limiting outdoor watering, banning washing hard surfaces, banning washing cars in your driveway, limiting water usage as much as you can. And there are more intense restrictions for large commercial users, utilities, people who suck, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of gallons out. So they are saying that if we conserve as much as we can now, we might be able to avoid stage three restrictions. People who were here in 2007 might remember that. That's the last time we were in that stage. And it looks like unless we get a lot more rain and really start cutting down on water usage, we are, headed for more trouble.
Yes, and this is this drought began during the fall and winter when evaporation on the lakes is much less than it is in the summertime. So if we don't get a substantial amount of rain, and I think in some cases somebody said they needed 17 inches of rain in a very short amount of time to replenish the water supplies and make crops grow and things like that. But if we don't get it as conditions warm, we could be in serious trouble. So that began today, correct? The water restrictions?
Yes, and we'll have more about the exact restrictions. We actually have a reporter this hour going to talk to Charlotte Water about what people in the city will see in terms of the exact penalties and such that they could face if don't obey.
If that person knows anything before the end of this program, bring them on. In a surprising move, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board rejects Superintendent Crystal Hill's proposed $2.1 billion budget on a vote of 8-1. Eli, why?
Well, it is a little bit of a mystery. James Farrell, our education reporter, has been trying to find out more information. The board clearly surprised Superintendent Crystal Hill. You know, by the time they reach this point with a $2.1 billion budget, they've been through a lot of questions. They've been through the public hearings. Approval is kind of a formality at this point. The board members said that they want to make sure that the budget aligns with goals like reducing student achievement gaps and getting teachers resources. Those are very general things that the superintendent talks about all the time anyway. And there weren't any specific asks like you need to spend more on hiring more teachers. Crystal Hill was, I think, clearly blindsided, and the meeting got testy, and it was very unusual. It's the first meeting I've seen where the board chair cut off, you know, kind of the principal staff member with a gavel.
Yeah, that happened when Crystal Hill asked for more direction because she was told to come back in 2 weeks with a new budget, but she was uncomfortable about how to proceed, and she asked for clarity.
I guess we will bypass our 11-day rule because for the May 12th board meeting, materials are due this Friday. So I just want to be clear that we have a $2.1 billion budget. I do not have clarity on what exactly needs to be amended.
Dr. Hill.
I do not feel comfortable taking that direction outside of a board action.
So we will address whatever meetings there will be, not tonight, and you will get direction.
That's Stephanie Sneed, who is the chairman of the school board. And with that comment, she gaveled the meeting to a close, as you pointed out, Eli. It's interesting to me that they made a point of saying this is not about Crystal Hill's performance. It is not about the performance of the schools. And yet it got pretty testy pretty quickly for, I think, a valid ask for direction. Why?
Yeah, it was a really weird dynamic because if you think back and remember to the fall, the people who criticized Crystal Hill, board members like Lisa Stone and Summer Nunn, they lost. So people were saying coming into this new school board, it was all Hill supporters, and there were worries that the board was going to be too compliant for to the superintendent's direction. That was clearly not the case, but it was also kind of this weird, like, it almost felt like a breakup dynamic where you're like, I really don't want to tell this person what is so bad about them. I don't want to tell them. I want to let them down easy. The board members kept saying, we're really happy with you, Dr. Hill. We're really happy with what you've done with the schools. But this budget, we're not going to go. We're not going to do it. So it was a weird meeting. It was a tense meeting, and it is not a dynamic that we've seen with this school board and this superintendent before.
$21 billion is a lot of money. $2.1 billion is a lot of money. The system has been witnessing a declining enrollment in the last year or so. They are also experiencing uncertainty because a large portion of the budget is funded by the state, and the state still lacks a budget. And District 1 board member Charlita Hatch pointed out that right now, quote, we are operating within a funding structure defined by the state, which has demonstrated year over year that it does not fully prioritize public education, particularly in urban communities like ours. Our community deserves a budget that reflects what it actually takes to deliver our goals. David, what does that tell you, if anything, about the board's problem with the budget as presented? Is it not enough?
I don't know where else the money is going to come from, though, in this situation. More than anything, it just looks politically chaotic. As Eli said, you just don't really see this too often. I mean, board chairs are able to set agendas. You would expect there would be some type of being on the same page with the superintendent. So to have a vote of this magnitude, 8-1 against it, just appears like a very public rebuke. I think a breakup is a great way to put it. The concerning part about this for me was all the conversation from the board members about, we'll tell you about what we want afterwards, and the superintendent saying, well, we should do this transparently in board meetings. There is now a special scheduled meeting on the budget for tomorrow at 8 a.m. if anybody is a glutton for punishment and wants to chime in on that on a Saturday morning.
Board member also said they wanted to address student achievement gaps and student mental health, and they wanted that addressed in the next draft of the budget. Are we pretty far along on the process of this budget that this is just now coming up? And we've been talking about, Eli, this $2.1 billion budget for weeks now. Why has it come as a surprise that they're not happy?
Well, they asked questions, and they submit written questions, and James Farrell, our education reporter, did a public records request and got those questions and answers back. And there are some of them that the CMS staff doesn't appear to have fully answered, like how exactly teacher allotments are made when you factor in state funding and some things like that. Some board members, like Charlita Hatch, have said, look, we're not getting enough answers. But to David's point and your point, it's really far along. They're supposed to submit their budget request to the county by May 15th. The county then votes on it. So, like David was saying, yes, sure, everybody wants more money to support student mental health. I don't think anyone's opposed to that, but they're already asking for more money from the county than they got last year. The state is not giving more money. CMS does not have taxing power, so it's not totally clear to me who the board wants her to ask more or for more money.
I guess we'll find out, as will Crystal Hill tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in that special meeting. The public is invited to it. It's at the city government building or the county government building, and you can go.
Yeah, and it's not clear it'll stream, which is, I think, a big transparency problem for people who are interested. You know, this affects hundreds of thousands of people, and they're choosing to have it on a Saturday morning, and they have not said if they're going to use the building streaming capabilities so the public can see without driving to the government center.
Okay. NASCAR driver Greg Biffle and his entire immediate family and three others, of course, died in a plane crash in Statesville in December. And then in January, someone broke into Greg Biffle's family home. This was a local story until, I think, yesterday or the day before. Suddenly it's become a national story, and you're reporting, David, with your investigative team, that a new search warrant reveals important developments in this case. What did you find?
Yeah, so I was able to find search warrants that were filed in Iredell County that point to more than just the burglary. So as you mentioned, there was a break-in at the home, and there's been video released of a person of interest walking around the home. That was in January of this year. Search warrants that we found filed by detectives showed that the bank accounts and Venmo accounts of Greg Biffle and Christina Grosu, Greg Biffle's wife, were compromised in December. Passwords were changed, different information in those accounts. A check was cashed in South Carolina. And this was all before the break-in ever happened. Some of what we've seen in the search warrants points to the possibility of an inner circle of friends of the Biffles possibly being involved in either the alleged bank fraud or the break-in. But it definitely points to a pretty sad picture, paints a very sad picture of people who are looking to take advantage after this awful tragedy.
Yeah, back in January, Iredell County detectives reported that about $30,000 to $40,000 in cash and two firearms had been reported stolen from the home. And there's a video, at least that looks like a woman who took her good sweet time walking through that house for a long time looking for things. She's heavily masked. But the warrant that you've just talked about shows that hundreds of thousands of dollars were taken. I guess that's from bank accounts through this fraud?
That's from the alleged bank fraud, yeah.
Okay. And I'm curious why somebody would keep $30,000 to $40,000 in cash in their home. That's
You know, that's a good question too. I don't know if that's something that detectives are looking into. The way that they wrote about it in the search warrant, they claimed that the person who's seen on video walking around the home knew the home, that they had been there before, they were familiar with the property. They spent something like 5 hours there. And the allegations in the search warrant are this person knew where the multiple cameras were and security cameras inside the home. So detectives are really leaning into the inner circle possibility of this person of interest. They have a person of interest. They have not named who that person is. You know, WBTV, we've decided not to name some of the individuals in the search warrant because no one has been arrested at this point in time. But there's a group of people that detectives are definitely looking at.
Okay. When it comes to Medicaid, the heat has been turned down, at least in North Carolina, because Governor Stein signed a bill extending Medicaid coverage through the end of the year. We'll talk about that. Teachers are marching in Raleigh today for better pay. And some interesting things happening on City Council with I-77 and potential data centers. We'll talk about that, too, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup with Eli Portillo, David Hodges, Mary C. Curtis, and Hunter Sines from Channel 9. It's WFAE Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Hunter Science is with us from Channel 9, WSOC-TV. Right across the aisle, David Hodges is here from WBTV. They like each other. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist and host for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eli Portillo is executive editor here at WFAE News. We reported last week that the General Assembly was working on a bill to backfill the Medicaid shortfall that would have occurred before the end of the year. Lawmakers reached an agreement with near unanimous consent this week and passed a bill which Governor Stein signed into law just 2 days after the passage of that bill. What will this $319 million do, Eli?
So this allows people who are on Medicaid because of Medicaid expansion to continue on that. It's more than 700,000 people who are covered by that. It allows the state's Medicaid program to continue paying the same rates and not have to cut further for doctors. It also includes provisions that, even though it passed with strong bipartisan support, some immigration advocates are really concerned about. It requires that the state report people who it's not able to verify their citizenship to federal authorities. So, you know, you have people who are worried that people whose children are eligible for Medicaid, but they are not because they're not citizens, you know, might not use it anymore because they'll be concerned about that. So it does have those enforcement provisions. But despite that, the governor and other Democratic leaders basically said the good outweighs the bad in this situation, and the state needs to spend this money to continue covering, basically 750,000 people.
When you say it passed with incredible bipartisan support, that's putting it mildly. It passed the House 112-1 and the Senate 48-1. Did Democrats feel that they had to hold their nose to vote for this out of necessity, out of expediency?
I think some did. Democrats who are maybe from more purplish districts, I think, didn't have to hold their nose for it. But there are definitely some Democrats from strongly blue districts who, you know, were concerned about the enforcement provisions. And our reporter, Julian Berger, talked to some of them about that. But again, they looked at it as a necessity. And, you know, let's be frank, nobody wants to go into the midterm elections having cost hundreds of thousands of people Medicaid coverage.
Well, in signing the bill, Governor Stein said, "We are reinforcing the state's health care system by fully funding Medicaid." But the coverage, as you pointed out, excludes undocumented immigrants.
Which
and
was the case before.
Right.
You know, they're not able to access Medicaid.
Correct. So it seems redundant, but it removes the ability for refugees who have a green card but not citizenship to receive benefits. So if this is helping the state's healthcare system, how? Because if these people aren't covered and they get sick and they have to go to a rural hospital mostly, the hospital is stuck with the tab.
Yeah, and I think the numbers are just much larger in terms of who's covered than who might lose coverage. For example, you know, you have more than 700,000 people covered under Medicaid expansion. Medicaid will be fully funded to allow payments. By contrast, Governor Stein said 27,000 women in those categories you mentioned would lose coverage. So I think, you know, when they weighed the numbers, they felt like the state's healthcare system still comes out ahead.
Okay, Hunter, time to wake up. Several area school systems canceled classes today because so many teachers asked for leave so that they could participate in a march in Raleigh for higher pay. How many systems around this area are out of school today?
My alarm clock just went off, Mike. You got me just in time. There are several in our area who are out of school, including CMS. I mean, we've known about this for at least the past week. I started hearing neighbors around my area be like, is this actually going to happen? Is this real? And at the time, we had over 1,000 teachers at CMS alone that were calling out or planning to call out. And now it is thousands that have called out. So they cannot operate. It's actually a teacher work day today. I don't know how many teachers will be working, but if you count protesting as work, then they're working today in Raleigh.
Senate leader Phil Berger has criticized this march, saying teachers, quote, refuse to work on a day they are supposed to work, and arguing that the rally is unlikely to move the needle with lawmakers. Considering the position and his position among lawyers, lawmakers, is he right, Mary? Are they just wasting their time, spinning their wheels?
Well, I mean, they feel like they have to do something, and there is some stress and pressure on them. You know, North Carolina used to be known for its education, public education system. Now our teacher pay is, I believe, 46th among 50, which puts us below all of our surrounding states. So they're having problems recruiting and retaining good, experienced teachers. So I think they probably feel that if they elevate their grievances enough and their demands, that perhaps this state legislature that doesn't have a budget at all will feel a certain amount of pressure to do it. So they have to do something.
But Hunter, this is not the first time teachers have marched on Raleigh for higher pay. Did anything come from those earlier marches? Do we know? I mean, have there been any? Has it brought more attention to their plight? Has it resulted in better raises in the unpassed budget for them?
I know districts have tried to work on temporary raises for teachers or hiring extra teacher assistants and stuff since that last protest. I think it has brought more attention to it. I think that there is clearly a pulse amongst not only teachers, but parents whose kids are being taught by teachers who are being paid. I mean, it should be inexcusable what they are being paid. When Mary said they're 46th in the country, I mean, that's a really sad reality. So I think it's really unfair for some state lawmakers to try to make a joke out of their protest when they are just asking to get the pay that they believe they rightfully deserve. I don't know if it's going to, you know, I don't know if it's going to work. As Mary said, when we don't have a state budget, and then we just talked about CMS voting to not approve their current budget right now. But I think there is this huge support right now when it comes to our teachers and the parents that are asking that their kids' teachers be more respected and be better paid so that we can have better educators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they certainly seem to find enough time to give our tax monies to private schools. And so it's a matter of priorities as well.
Data centers have become a hot topic recently, but this week Mayor Vi Lyles cast the tie-breaking vote, which means that there will be no public hearings on data centers in Charlotte for now. Eli, why the delay?
So Councilmember Dimple Ajmera has been publicly advocating for a pause on data centers near residential areas in Charlotte, saying the city shouldn't approve them, at least until we have more regulations and a better understanding of energy, water usage, etc. The council split 5-5 on whether to move ahead with a public hearing. That would be the first step towards an actual limited moratorium. And the mayor cast the deciding vote, as you said, against that. That doesn't mean that they're not going to talk about it. Basically, instead of a public hearing, now they're going to just have a nice little chat on May 11th, where they're not going to formally start moving something forward, but they're going to talk about it more.
And David, you spoke, I think, to several council members about this. Councilmember Dimple Ajmera proposed a motion to put a public hearing on the calendar.
My motion was not about anti-growth or anti-development or anti-AI or anti-data centers. This is about smart growth. It's about putting guardrails in place where we are requiring developers to put some protections for our community, especially our water, our electricity grid, and most importantly, our health.
And while half of the council agreed, the other half did not, including Dante Anderson, who wants more time to do research.
We can have a public forum anytime, and we will more than likely on this very issue. But as an entire council, we have not had one full robust conversation around data centers. But if the council doesn't have a baseline of knowledge, then it's not making best use of that public forum. So better to have the council caucus get caught up, and then we can have a public forum.
So clearly, David, the mayor sided with those who want to wait on a public forum. Is that why? Time to get more information?
Well, I'll actually credit our reporter, Katie Solt, for doing those interviews, but I always appreciate the credit from you, Mike. I believe that having a conversation, one of the first conversations at large about data centers and possibly implementing a moratorium is something I think the city council and generally Charlotte business interests don't really want to see out of its local government. We are seeing that happen a lot in various communities surrounding Charlotte and in some of these more conservative areas where you're kind of seeing NIMBYism pick up a lot. But I think in Charlotte, the mayor's kind of thought process on this and some of the council members who voted against having a hearing on a moratorium is, let's gather more information first before we just put down a blanket stop on this. Now, however, these data centers are very unpopular. They come into a community, they don't employ anybody, they take up a lot of resources. There's a lot of money being spent to try and figure out a better way to spend these types of centers. So I also understand where Councilmember Ajmer is coming from on this, because I would bet that most of her constituents are not in favor of this.
And yeah,
it's my understanding they'd be great for the drought that we're in with all the water usage.
Dimple Ajmer, whose idea it was to hold this public hearing, clearly was not happy with the outcome of this vote.
We have been discussing this issue for at least 2.5 years with no action, and that is unacceptable.
What has taken so long, Eli?
Well, for one, it's not clear to me that the city, you know, has a ton of leverage here. There's also the undercurrent of, okay, if they deny a bunch of these, people, you know, are also worried then the state comes in, as we've seen before, and says municipalities can't prohibit data centers. Remember, that's what happened back, oh gosh, almost a decade ago with ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft. The city wanted to regulate them, and the state just passed a law saying, no, cities can't regulate them. So that could very plausibly happen. But let's also put some politics into this. The New York Times just has a big story today that says data centers are the one issue that Democrats and Republicans in this very polarized time agree by huge margins, like more than 2-1, that they hate. Dimple Ajmer and some other people on council would likely like to be the next Charlotte mayor. When we could have an open seat next year for people to run for. So, you know, there's definitely an element of politics here. And I think opposing data centers is starting to look more and more like a smart political move.
And WBTV spoke with some neighbors of a data center that's being proposed for the university area. One of them, Antoinette Mingo, was concerned about the city losing its charm as these data centers gobble up green space, particularly green space near her home.
Demand for electricity, which they require a lot of, that's going to cause me to pay a lot more for utilities to include water. And when I think about the droughts situation we were in now, what would have happened if we had that monstrosity online right now?
So when will this come up for discussion on council?
May 11th. Mark your calendars. They'll talk about it. And then presumably after that, we'll have another meeting to talk some more.
City Council was also busy this week proposing a resolution to pause the I-77 expansion project. Right now, the state has paused that project for a couple of months to give citizens more time to look at the proposed plans and to give their input. Would this be an additional pause?
Well, we got to get into the weeds a little bit. The city's draft resolution directs Ed Driggs, who is the member of the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization, to advocate for a pause and to ask that organization and the NCDOT to stop procurement and irreversible actions until they've examined alternatives. There's a conflict already about what that wording means. It's almost Clintonian. Some council members seem to think that procurement means the state wouldn't move forward with a request for proposals from developers. Ed Driggs told our Steve Harrison that procurement means actually signing a contract, so the project could keep moving forward short of that.
This would give the council more time to evaluate the project. Are they really evaluating the project, or are they merely evaluating, Mary, the reaction to the project?
I think both. I mean, they've made, as Eli was putting out, so many deals, it's kind of far along the road. And I think we've gotten to the point where every time we talk about I-77 expansion, we use the adjective controversial, because if citizens are weighing in, they want to talk about, you know, the environmental effects. Would toll lanes really solve the traffic problem? Looking at them engaging with the community more, which I think they feel that they were left out of that process. Now, they opened this engagement center, that was a piece of it, but they feel they still want more input. And so I think the reaction to it has been a lot more, I think, and a lot more focused and intentional and persistent than perhaps they had anticipated. So they have this proposal now. It's a proposed resolution, and we'll see what happens next.
And of course, no matter which plan they go for, which of these proposed plans, or perhaps another one, I don't know, but there's a plan to elevate it. There's been a plan to widen it. Some people have suggested burying these new toll lanes. Any of those plans is going to have some sort,
yes,
of impact, negative impact on neighborhoods on the west side. And Sustain Charlotte has been concerned about this for a long time, has been a leader in opposing this plan. Sustain Charlotte founder and executive director Shannon Binns.
The DOT was hesitant to slow down. And unfortunately, our city council was also hesitant to slow down.
He told he told WBTV that it's been surprising and concerning that it's taken this long, but he added this.
I do think they've taken too long, but hey, you know, better late than never.
So this is a proposed resolution. Who's floating this idea? Who floated the resolution, and where does it stand in the next 20 seconds?
Yeah, so the resolution will be discussed at that same May 11th meeting. They could vote on it then, and we'll see what happens after that. But, you know, this project is not stopping yet, are the indications we have.
Okay. Duke Energy's requesting a rate hike in June, just in time for air conditioning to take over. There was a street takeover, speaking of takeovers, on I-77. Don't see that happening very often. Hunter has information on that, and a bill has been filed in the legislature to expand school protections for immigrant children. We'll talk about all those and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, executive editor for WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and David Hodges, investigative reporter for WBTV. A new bill was filed on Tuesday in the North Carolina House by Charlotte area Democratic Representative Julia Greenfield. It would expand protections for immigrant students in public schools. In what way, Eli?
So it would basically enshrine in North Carolina law that the Plyler v. Doe Supreme Court decision that said children have a right to a public education regardless of immigration and citizenship status applies here. So it would say proactively, yes, you are guaranteed. And it would also prohibit some ways schools could work with immigration authorities. It's not clear to me that any schools are actually doing any work with immigration authorities that this would prohibit, but it would preemptively do those.
Let me ask you this. You just mentioned Plyler v. Doe, which was the U.S. Supreme Court decision that established the right of undocumented children to attend public schools. So why do we need a law?
Well, I think it's interesting as a possible look ahead at what the next frontiers of fights could be. You know, we've seen this with other cases that were considered settled, most notably Roe versus Wade. And We're also seeing, of course, challenges to the Voting Rights Act, like the one that was just announced, decided this week. So just because something is a Supreme Court precedent certainly does not mean the way people used to assume that it was settled forever. So you could be looking at what the next fight, the next frontier in immigration enforcement looks like here.
Mary.
Yeah, also we saw in the last actions by ICE and Border Patrol that some of the places and spaces like hospitals and schools and churches, places of worship that were supposed to be off limits, actually were breached. And so I think they want to put something down that it's a law, because things, as we've seen, that are traditions or even laws have been violated and questioned. So I just think also they're reacting to the experiences of kids who were kept out of school, and when they really had the right to an education.
I would assume that since we have a Republican-controlled legislature that has been very vocal in their dissatisfaction with jurisdictions who seem to be sticklers when it comes to compliance with ICE, that this bill is dead on arrival.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this bill is going to move anywhere at all. But, you know, I do think it's a marker for what could be coming next.
Two Charlotte area Democrats in the legislature from Mecklenburg have now left the Democratic Party following their primary defeats. Carla Cunningham's announcement to that effect was quickly followed by that of Nasif Majid. In making his announcement, Majid gave this reason to WCNC-TV.
The Democratic Party left me.
Is that similar to Carla Cunningham's reasoning, Mary?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, she angered the Democratic base, of course, with her actions on some of the immigration laws where she sided with Republicans, and also some of her remarks about immigrants. And Majid, the same way. He, of course, sided with Republicans on some of their actions of overriding Governor Josh Stein's veto when it came to things like religion in schools, gender policy. Both of them voted, of course, to limit the to reduce the climate targets of Duke Energy. And so in their minds, I believe they feel that they are voting more their conscience. And I think Democrats would say you were elected to actually support Democratic goals for your constituents, and you're working against them in the legislature. We don't know exactly what they're gonna do next, but they are gonna say they're gonna serve their constituents for the rest of the term, but they will be unaffiliated.
Both Cunningham and Majid have taken heat in recent months for the very reasons that you just cited, voting to override vetoes with Republicans, voting with Republicans on passage of certain bills, and their reasons for leaving the Democratic Party sound very much like those of Trisha Kothum, who left the party a couple of years ago, in part because she said the party no longer tolerated independent thought. And here's what Majid told WCNC-TV.
They censored me. This is something unheard of, unprecedented. They censored me. They spent over $500,000 against me for a campaign and TV ad.
The Democratic Party likes to call itself the Big Tent Party. Is that still true today? And couldn't charges of being forced to toe the party line, Mary, be leveled at both parties?
Well, I think they would say the folks that ran against them was you were primaried by another candidate, which, and they had a different set of policies that they supported, and the voters voted for. They were both voted out in the primaries by very wide margins. I do think when you both parties can be accused of that. I mean, you no longer have many pro-life Democrats or free choice Republicans on a variety of issues. But we've seen politics, but America also becoming more polarized.
And I think
I'll just point out too that Democrats have literally no power in the state. The only lever they have is to be able to hold up a veto. So when you side with the Republicans to take that away, it is essentially completely neutered party. So I understand why voters decided that was a big enough issue.
Well, plus the fact the voters in primaries, the voters in primaries are to the far left of the Democratic Party and to the far right of the Republican Party, and they're the people with all the say on who runs in November. And if you don't kowtow to them, you don't get elected. You can't. It's hard to be a moderate Republican or a moderate Democrat. Yeah. And you mentioned that we, since they're independents, they're both now unaffiliated. There's a question about who they, which party they will caucus with. If they want to have any influence on any piece of legislation going through the legislature. Here's what Nasif Majid said about that.
I'm evaluating that whole process, taking input from my constituents, people who are wise in this area and who contribute to my decision. And so that's a working process.
So we can get answers to, we will get answers to that, those and many other questions on Monday. Carla Cunningham and Nasif Majid will be on the program for the
hour. Mike, I'd like to point out, though, when you talked about far left and far right, what is considered that has really shifted. You know, what is considered now far light, far right and far left, that Overton window, things that we might have considered moderate, some people might say were far left. So we have to take that in consideration also.
We have a lot of systemic things in our political system that are broken, that need to be addressed, or we are doomed, as they used to say in that television commercial a long time ago. We've heard of city streets, Hunter, being taken over by cars and motorcycles and people doing donuts and swirlies in the middle of an intersection. You don't hear much about that happening on an interstate, but it did on I-77 on Sunday. What happened?
Yeah, and we heard about it, and it kind of went all over social media. So there were individuals in masks who were out walking on I-77 right near the Lakeview Road Bridge in North Charlotte. And of course, that brought the traffic to a halt when you see people there. And then they lit fires on the actual interstate. And then all of a sudden, fireworks started going off under the bridge that they lit. We spoke, Joe Bruno spoke to a woman who videoed some of it. She was in the car with her child. She said it was really scary for her. I will say state troopers are over this investigation since it happened on I-77. So CMPD's street takeover team wasn't necessarily investigating this. And we have not heard of any arrests from this. But just think about how chaotic it must be to for not only for that to happen, but of course, not only people using the interstate to get where they need to go, but think about emergency personnel, ambulances who may need to be on the interstate, and then they're backed up in traffic because of this nonsense.
One person who saw a video that WBTV showed them had this to say about what he saw on the video.
It's something that shouldn't be happening, especially even on the interstate.
Now, that's the understatement of the year. was this planned? Was this organic? Do we know who these people are, were?
We don't know who these people are, were. based on the video, I would say it was planned. I'm not investigating this, but I mean, they were masked people who took over the interstate. I don't really think these people were just changing a tire and said, let's do this.
I've investigated some of these in the past, and they're, to Hunter's point, there's social media accounts that are constantly changing, where people are proposing these types of takeovers. It's a constantly shifting target for law enforcement to figure out where these messages are happening. And yeah, this is the first time we got a highway patrol investigating one of these. So we'll see if any arrests come out of it.
This is really dangerous and very scary for motorists and other people who are trapped in their cars while this is going on around them. What is the penalty if they find out who these people are? What kind of penalties are there for taking over an interstate highway?
So now there, because of a new bill that was recently passed, there is jail time that you face for these street takeovers, and then they can seize your cars, they can seize anything that is in association with that street takeover. So we do have law enforcement having some more teeth on enforcing this, and that's why we've seen CMPD crack down on the ones that are in parking lots or neighborhood streets. And they've had some success in making a point, but it's really hard to get ahead of these things, as David said, because they take down these social media accounts just as soon as an event happens. And so the next event is planned on a completely different social media account.
Oh, gosh. Okay. We mentioned at the very start of the program that this area has just gone into stage two drought conditions, which means mandatory water restrictions are now in place. And we now have more information about that, Eli.
Yep. So in Charlotte, folks are limited to watering their lawns no more than 2 days per week and only at night. Odd-numbered addresses on Tuesday and Saturday, even numbers on Wednesday and Sunday.
Wasn't that already in place?
No, it was asking people.
Oh, they were asking.
Yeah, okay, now it's mandatory. And you can't fill new swimming pools. You can't power wash. Charity or fundraising car wash events are banned right now. And water features like fountains must be turned off. So we are going to start seeing the effects of this in day-to-day life and the landscape now.
And just in time for summer air conditioning season, Duke Energy wants to raise rates in June to cover fuel and power costs. This is to cover $809 million they incurred from September of last year to February of this year. Has this been done in the past? Eli? David. Unless Hannah wants to chime in.
I don't know if it's been done in the past, but I can tell you what they're doing right now, Mike. They are looking to raise these rates this summer to cover these fuel costs, essentially, that the utility occurred between September 2025 and February 2026. The way that Duke passes on these costs, it's not to make money for themselves, but essentially just a straight pass on to customers, with the company neither gaining or losing money on these transactions. And it could end up costing people, if I'm looking at this right, around an extra $7 monthly starting on June 1st.
And this is really just because of the record-breaking usage that we had during the winter months. And it cost Duke like $809 million because what they were doing is they were buying from other companies.
So, Hunter, there's a program where individuals accused of various domestic violence charges are allowed to be out of jail as long as they wear ankle monitors, electronic monitors. And now the funding for that program is at risk. Why?
Yeah, so we need $4 million from state lawmakers for the Criminal Justice Information Network's electronic monitoring program, or else we risk 1,000+. Of these ankle monitors getting off of defendants who are actively having pending charges of very serious domestic violence charges. It's really a funding issue, Mike.
Why do you need $4 million? What's the money for?
So it's the technology of the electronic monitoring and then the tracking system. It's actually kind of neat how they are able to track if you get in a certain circumference where you are not supposed to be, let's say a victim's house. It notifies them immediately. It also notifies the victim for his or her protection. So all of that, of course, employment of the people who are notifying all these individuals. It's just a huge cost. Also, it's offered to any county in the state. Not all of them use it. Mecklenburg doesn't use it, but Iredell County uses it. And so they are also wanting to expand. So for them to expand, they would need this extra money too.
Meanwhile, Mecklenburg County DA Spencer Merriweather has advocated for changes in our strangulation law for a while, and a recent case has allowed him to bring that topic back to the fore. Fill us in.
Yeah, there was a defendant by the name of DeMont Forte who is seen on video putting his hands around a woman's neck on his front porch. To anybody in common sense, you would think it is strangling someone. However, the jury, once they were instructed by North Carolina's strangulation laws, found him not guilty of strangulation, but guilty of assault on a female. And even some of the jurors, I am told, were flabbergasted. They thought this was a slam dunk, and it wasn't, because our laws currently force the DA's office to prove that physical injuries stemmed from the actual act of strangulation. That's really a hard thing to prove when there are other assaults, punching, kicking, that's going on, ramming them to the floor. And so they are trying to get that portion of the law changed and increase the penalties, because right now, those penalties are the same as somebody who's breaking into your backyard shed with that nobody is in. It's probation a lot of the times.
And finally, a big payday for Bryce Young, the quarterback for the Panthers. They just signed an extension for 1 year. They will pay him $25.904 million in 2027, which is more than David Hodges makes. He had a rough rookie start.
You don't know
start.
Me.
He had a good year last year, Mike. He had a really good year.
So
we squeaked into the playoffs.
And they have an ability to give him, a multi-year extension at any time. Are they waiting to see what happens in the coming season before they ink those papers?
That hasn't come yet. We will see. And I guess there's a lot of stress on Mr. Young to repeat those numbers.
25.
I'll take that salary and that stress.
Yeah, it's pocket change. David Hodges, investigative reporter, WBTV. Hunter Sines, reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary C. Curtis with RollCall.com and Equal Time. And Eli Portillo with WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.